What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Donald Ray Pollock grew up in tiny Knockemstiff, Ohio, way down in the state's southern hills, just 50 miles or so from Kentucky. He dropped out of high school, worked some 30 years in a paper mill, and now, at 53, is coming out with a debut collection of short stories called Knockemstiff. They are not the kind of stories a Chamber of Commerce will be trumpeting anytime soon. They're shocking, grim, desperate. This hour, On Point, Donald Ray Pollock's Knockemstiff, Ohio. Joining me now from Columbus, Ohio, is Donald Ray Pollock. He was born and raised in Knockemstiff, Ohio. He's out with a new collection of short stories by the same name, Knockemstiff. It's getting rave reviews and raised eyebrows at its complete grimness. The LA Times calls Knockemstiff a powerful, remarkable, exceptional book that is very hard to read. Donald Ray Pollock, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
You know it. You were born and raised there. You've lived it. Is it as bad as all this?
No. Pretty much what I did was I took the reputation that Knockemstiff had when I was growing up there back in the 60s and cranked it up about 10 notches. And so, yeah, the holler wasn't ever as bad as the way my book portrays it.
But this isn't exactly a realm of sunshine. Even if you divide by 10, the Salt Lake Tribune reads your book. It says, if America has an underbelly, you're from it. You know, stories is full of their list here. Rape, murder, incest, drug use, alcoholism, molestation, sodomy, hate crime, masochism, sadism, mechanical sex, creepy sex, rehab stints, halfway houses. And that's before we even get to snake bites and steroids. They say, write what you know. Is the baseline here what you know?
Well, I guess I was always attracted to the dark. And in my reading, I sort of gravitated towards, Southern Gothic and crime fiction and that sort of thing. So I have to admit it was pretty easy for me to write, this sort of thing. It's not as easy to write a happy story, say, for me. And I've seen, a lot of harsh things, and I guess that's where the fiction comes from.
Yeah, it's quite the collection. Jonathan Miles, writing about it in the New York Times, reminds us of that precipice that Flannery O'Connor had in mind when she wrote about the moment in every great story in which the presence of grace can be felt as it waits to be accepted or rejected. Then he writes about Knockemstiff, your collection. He says, grace barely flickers across these pages, but when it is sensed, Pollock's characters almost invariably reject it, surrendering to nihilism, trying to forget they ever had a chance. Chalk it up perhaps to civic pride, the Knockemstiff way. What a place, even in the realm of fiction, and yet there really is a town named that. Where did that come from? Knockemstiff, Ohio. What's the origin?
Well, Knockemstiff is a very small, tiny community about 13 miles west of Chillicothe, Ohio, which is, down in southern Ohio.
Where you live now, yeah.
Yeah, I live in Chillicothe now. Mm-hmm. And as far as how the town got its name, I heard several different stories when I was growing up. One is that, and I included in my book, that two women were fighting about one lady's husband, and a preacher happened by and advised the wife to knock her stiff. Now, that seems like a pretty silly story, even to me. But it has been around maybe since the 1930s, that particular story. Another story, which is probably more to the, how it really got its name, is that there used to be a lot of moonshiners around that area. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the say, slang words for moonshine.
Sounds like that would do it. That would suggest a potent brew.
Yes.
I wish you'd read for us so we can begin to get a flavor here. The very first story in your collection, Knock'em Stiff, is called Real Life, Donald Ray Pollock. Don, I wish you'd give us a read just right from the top of the story, if you would.
Okay. I guess I better add before I start that this is not a family-friendly book at all, and I've I'm substituting a couple words here to make it a little bit more, I guess, radio-friendly.
Thank you very much.
But you're welcome. This is from real life. My father showed me how to hurt a man one August night at the Torch Drive-In when I was 7 years old. It was the only thing he was ever any good at. This was years ago, back when the outdoor movie experience was still a big deal in southern Ohio. Godzilla was playing, along with some sorry-ass flying saucer movie that showed how pie pans could take over the world. It was hotter than hell that evening, and by the time the cartoon began playing on the big plywood screen, the old man was miserable. He kept bitching about the heat, sopping the sweat off his head with a brown paper bag. Ross County hadn't had any rain in 2 months. Every morning, my mother turned the kitchen radio to KB98 and listened to Miss Sally Flowers pray for a thunderstorm. Then she'd go outside and stare at the empty white sky that hung over the holler like a sheet. Sometimes, I still think about her standing in that brittle brown grass, stretching her neck in hopes of seeing just one lousy dark cloud. "Hey, Vernon, watch this," she said that night. Ever since we'd parked, she'd been trying to show the old man that she could stick a hot dog down her throat without messing up her shiny lipstick. You've got to understand, my mother hadn't been out of Knock'em Stiff all summer. Just seeing a couple of red lights had made her all goosey. But every time she gagged on that wiener, the ropey muscles in the back of my old man's neck twisted a little tighter, made it seem as if his head was going to pop off any second. My older sister, Jeanette, had used her head and played sick all day, then talked him into letting her stay at a neighbor's house. So there I was, stuck in the back seat by myself, chewing the skin off my fingers, and hoping Mom wouldn't piss him off too much before Godzilla stomped the guts out of Tokyo. But really, it was already too late. Mom had forgotten to pack the old man's special cup, and so everything was shot to hell as far as he was concerned. He couldn't even muster a chuckle for Popeye, let alone get excited about his wife doing tricks with a wrinkled-up Oscar Mayer. Besides, my old man hated movies. "Screw a bunch of make-believe," he'd say, whenever someone mentioned seeing the latest John Wayne or Robert Mitchum. "What the hell's wrong with real life?" He'd only agreed to the drive-in in the first place because of all the hell Mom had raised about his new car, a 1965 Impala he'd brought home the night before. It was the third set of wheels in a year. We lived on soup beans and fried bread, but drove around Knock'em Stiff like rich people. Just that morning, I'd heard my mother get on the phone and rag to her sister, the one who lived in town. "The SOB is crazy, Margie," she said. "We couldn't even pay the electric bill last month." I was sitting in front of the dead TV, watching watery blood trickle down her pale calves. She tried to shave them with the old man's straight razor, but her legs were like sticks of butter. A black fly kept buzzing around her bony ankles, dodging her mad slaps. "I mean it, Margie," she said into the black mouthpiece. "I'd be out of this hell hole in a minute if it wasn't for these kids."
Donald Ray Pollock reading from the top of the first story in his new collection, Knock'em Stiff, this short story called Real Life. And it just takes about 2 or 3 minutes, and you've put us right there. You hadn't really written at all until you were well into your 40s. You went off to Ohio State and took some classes here. We'll talk about how you got there. But when you, you know, sat down, I don't know, at the keyboard or pen and paper, is this the theme, the tone, the material that just came out?
Well, pretty much, you know, I started writing when I was 45, and I didn't know how to even start. And for a long time, I mostly just typed out other people's stories and tried to learn from that. it got me a little bit closer, you know, as far as the reading goes, I guess. And then when I started writing my own stuff, I kept writing more and more of my own stuff as I went along. This is sort of like what came out. Maybe 3 years into my so-called, I guess, apprenticeship, I did try to write some stories set in other parts of the country with other characters and, but I found out that I just didn't know enough about those other people. So right before I went to started graduate school, I turned back to Knock 'Em Stiff and started getting my material from there again.
And when you began to pump these out for your professors at Ohio State, did they look at you like, holy smokes, who is this, Rube from Knock 'Em Stiff? Or did they love the exoticism of it? I mean, these are out there on the fringe. Did it get them all excited from the ivory tower?
I had published a couple of my stories already with the Journal, which is the very small literary magazine mm-hmm. that OSU prints. And so a couple of the professors were already a little familiar with my work. And I have to say that I, got plenty of support there. And nobody really had anything, too negative to say about the material.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new collection of grim stories of depravity and hopelessness out of a town called Knock 'Em Stiff, Ohio. Donald Ray Pollock got in the writing game late, not until he was in his 40s. Now at 53, he's out with a collection that is turning a lot of heads. It's right out there on the ragged edge. We heard him read just a little bit from the very top of one of his stories, Real Life, and Before You Know It, father and son are in the bathroom at the drive-in, beating the tar out of a couple of other guys, and off it goes. We've got Heather calling from Tidewater, Virginia. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say my grandpa was the rural free delivery mail carrier in Knock 'Em Stiff when I was a kid.
Wow.
And I'm not kidding you. And I have a clear memory of making that ride with him one morning early, and I literally saw a man sitting in a creek bed in a rocking chair with a pipe in his mouth and water running over his bare toes, and he literally had a jug of moonshine in his lap. And I want to say that this is real, and I'm 43, and I've lived all over the world. I'm a military spouse, and everywhere I go, I tell people about Knock 'Em Stiff, and I tell them about Summit Hill, and I know Mr. Pollock will know what I'm talking about. I tell them about those places, and they don't believe me. That this is real and this is part of America. And, even if he's embellished, cool, kudos. Knock 'Em Stiff, by golly, it needs to be on the map because there's a lot of Knock 'Em Stiffs in the United States of America. And there's good people there with real stories. And, yeah, they're hard to look at, but they're real. And, Mr. Pollock, I also wanted to say my daddy retired from that same paper mill you worked at after 50 years, and I'm glad you got sprung. Good luck to you.
Heather,
thanks a lot,
that's
Heather.
Terrific. Don, there's an image for a story right there, a man in the creek bed in a rocking chair.
Yeah, that's might have been one of my relatives. I don't know.
Heather says, you go, Don. It's out there. It's real. And tell it like it is. And if you crank it up for art, why not?
Well, yeah, I'm hoping that most people feel that way.
And the paper mill that her father worked in for 50 years, you ought to be able to relate to that. You were there for 30-plus years.
Yeah, 32.
Is that in Chillicothe or Knock 'Em Stiff?
Yes. No, in Chillicothe.
Describe that mill, your work there, the economy that it's part of.
Well, I started there in 1973, and it was a union job, and it paid really good money. It was the best job, really, to have probably in Ross County, for the blue-collar person anyway. And it was a good place to work. It was a great place to work. And the last 18 years I was there, I worked in the boiler house and took care of the ash silos.
The ash silo. Now, what is that? They're burning something and it makes a silo?
We burn coal. Yeah, we mm-hmm. burn coal, and then the residue spilled over into these silos that were sort of like grain silos.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to keep those empty. It was a very dirty job, but it was a good job.
So you carried out the ash from a whole silo full of ash for 18 years.
Yep.
Wow. Were you thinking about, hey, maybe someday I'll write short stories and get out from behind this front-end loader or truck or whatever it was?
No, not most of that time anyway. I started writing. I left the mill in 2005. I'd started writing about 5 years before that. So, you know, the last 5 years, you know, I was sort of thinking that, maybe I can do something else with my life. I was pretty much, you know, that's what got me started writing in the first place is, I turned 45 and I went through this midlife shift or whatever you want to call it. And I was, had a lot of regrets about what I'd, done with my time here. And I just started asking myself, well, what would you really, how would you want to, spend the rest of your life? And this is what I came up with.
You write that we learned that you dropped out of high school sort of a year before you would have completed, went to work in a meatpacking plant, a little time in Florida installing air conditioners, in and out of rehab until the mid-1980s when you finally got off of drugs and alcohol. That time of your life you say you've got regrets about. Is it the work you did? Is it the inebriation that you were in? Or where do you point your regrets?
Well, I think it was a combination of all those things. I mean, when I was a kid, I had dreams like, every kid does. And I just thought that I would end up, doing something else. My father retired from the paper mill. My grandfather retired from the paper mill. And I just didn't want to, retire from the paper mill. But it really never bothered me much until I hit my mid-40s. And then I started thinking, mortality, I started having thoughts about, wasn't going to be around too much longer. So I wanted to spend the rest of that time, doing something that I really wanted to do.
And now you're out there with a collection of stories that get us way, way out where things are kind of, they're drugged, they're sexualized in all kinds of ways that don't make it into pretty pages. You've got incest and rape and molestation and OxyContin and huffing Bactine. That was a new one to me. You clearly came with a quiver full and ready to go here, and it is wild stuff. Let's go to Tim calling from East Providence, Rhode Island. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Pollack. Mr. Pollack, after hearing your excerpt, I'm just incredibly impressed. I happen to teach writing at the University of Rhode Island, which doesn't mean very much, generally speaking, but I'm telling you that your voice as a writer, absolutely authentic, and sometimes people make a big thing about how old a writer is when they start, but it seems to me if someone goes on to write and write something decent, whatever happened before that, it's completely appropriate and logical, and I don't think there are any mistakes if it leads to great writing.
Well, thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate that.
And I'm sure they're going to, find your work, and I'm going to be reading it to my students next semester. Absolutely authentic, and thank you for sharing it.
There you go. The Donald Ray Pollack wave hits East Providence, Rhode Island. There's applause for you, Don.
Yeah, I like that.
Let's hear more. Your voice comes out of its own zone, and we want to hear a little more. You've got a story in here called Rainy Sunday about a girl and her aunt sitting around. It's a very Donald Ray Pollack kind of setting here. Eventually, they're going to end up going out, looking for men, I guess.
Yes.
But dive in for us.
Okay, this is the first, about page and a half of Rainy Sunday. It was 1 o'clock in the morning on a rainy Sunday, and Sharon was sitting at the kitchen table, debating whether or not to stuff another slice of American cheese into her mouth, when Aunt Joan called, begging her niece to ride into town. "Would you mind we try one more time?" she said. Her voice sounded thick and fuzzy on the phone, and Sharon figured she'd been taking somebody else's pills again. Ever since her father died, Aunt Joan had been working in a nursing home in Meade, changing diapers and spooning soft food into the mouths of old people who'd worn out their welcome in this world. She considered their medication one of the perks of the job. Sharon pulled back the curtain and looked out the window. In the glow from the security light, she could see water standing several inches deep on the road in front of her house. "Lord, woman," she told her aunt, "it's still pouring down out there." She didn't want to go outside again. Earlier that day, she had gotten soaked chasing Dean, her damaged husband, around the yard. Now her throat hurt and she could feel a cold coming on. Sharon dreaded wet weather more than anything. "Please, honey, I'm so lonely tonight," Aunt Joan said. "I cross my heart. I won't ask you again." Sharon sighed. She had told her aunt the last time that she wasn't doing it anymore. Not only was it dangerous, it made her feel dirty. Besides, if Dean ever found out, she would never cash another one of his Social Security checks again. But tonight she couldn't think straight. Dean had the TV turned up full blast in the living room, listening to some big-mouthed preacher with frizzy blonde hair stuck up around his head like a halo. And no matter where Sharon went in the cramped house, she couldn't escape the sounds of televised religion. Everything was either pearly gates or boiling pits. So with Dean flapping his arms like an angel trying to fly through the ceiling, and the preacher pleading for more money, and Aunt Joan promising it was just the one more time, she caved in. "Look, this is the last time," Sharon said. "Are you sure you can drive?" "I'll be there in 10 minutes, Aunt Joan said, her voice already perking up. "And honey, don't wear that stupid ball cap. I need you looking nice."
Donald Ray Pollock, reading from Rainy Sunday in his new collection of short stories, Knock 'em Stiff. And, I don't know, within minutes or the hour, they're cruising, picking up guys at the Krispy Kreme. You know, her husband is damaged in this story. There are damaged people woven through really almost every page of every story in your collection. You know, there's a kind of a TV image of the American countryside, of the American small town. Then there's the Donray Pollock vision here. They look very different. Yours has got an awful lot more damage in it. What do you make when you watch, you know, sort of, I don't know, the way America's portrayed in television, let's say ads or shows, compared to the vision you're sharing here?
Well, that's an interesting question. I really don't think a whole lot about that. I mean, I don't really watch that much TV or anything, you know. I mean, gee.
But you know,
I guess,
what the images
you know, if we're
are.
Talking about Mayberry or, you know, the Andy Griffith Show, or and then there's this new show called Earl, I believe, or My Name is Earl.
Yeah.
You know, I think maybe they get it right in some ways, and, you know, of course, you know, they some of those shows, I guess, try to avoid the stuff that I look at, just because a lot of their viewers might not think it's entertaining, I suppose.
Do you see your world, your part of America, Knock 'em Stiff, Chillicothe, do you see it as damaged?
No, I don't think so. You know, I have always been obsessed, I guess, to a point anyway, with people who were living lives in which they felt trapped, or, you know, they were in situations in which, you know, they wish they could get out of, but it's a lot easier to wish that you could get out of it than to actually get out of it. And, you know, I sort of always kind of watched those people, you know, and I worked with guys at the paper mill, you know, who were, you know, sort of like me, you know, they wish they were doing something else with their life. But, you know, you get this good job and it's paying good money and you're there a few years, and after a while it's like you sort of accept that, well, this is it. You know, this is my life. So I've always been, you know, interested in that take, you know, with those people anyway, that they couldn't get out, you know, whether it be a problem with a relationship or drugs or mental illness or poverty or whatever, they're stuck.
Stories grim and drenched in sorrow and regret, says USA Today. Let's go to Chris calling from Boston. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I just wanted to say thanks very much for this program. I grew up in Nebraska, and I got to tell you, that set of short stories just captures the sort of Midwest white trash experience that I grew up with, and I really appreciate that kind of literature. So, thanks very much.
Great, Chris. Thanks very much. That goes straight to you, Don Pollock. Let's get another call here from Foxborough, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, I also grew up in a small town in southern Illinois, and I have to say this really sort of resonates. Although I must say that in the 50s, it was much more woebegone than it is today. One of the things I've noticed is that the number of businesses in my town of 900, it's all rural farm community, but the number of businesses was like, 25, 30 in a town of 900 in the 50s, but today there's probably less than 10. And the real impact is that you lose the middle class, which were really setting the direction for the town. And now you're just left with dysfunctional poor, and people don't want to leave. They're afraid to leave and go to the world.
Don Pollock, do you see it?
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. It's just like with Knockemstiff, which is, there were maybe, when I was growing up there in the 60s, there were maybe 400, 500 people living there, but there was a bar, bar carry out. There were three stores and a church, and it was its own little tiny community. I mean, we really didn't need, you really didn't need to go to town. You could get by just staying there in the holler. But today, the bar's gone. All of the stores are closed down, and the only gathering place is the church, as far as, social stuff. And then along with that, there was a big farm on the north side of Knockemstiff and another on the south side, and both of those have been sold off to a land company who then divided the land up into lots, and people are buying like their 5 or 15 acre mini farm and building a nice house out there, and it's pretty much some people describe it as a ghost town, and I guess I would go along with that, that it's not really a town anymore. And then you do have, the people who have been sort of left behind and because of lack of education or just, social skills or whatever, they stay on and live a pretty rough life.
And you tell their story, but you don't feel obligated to take it from that rough life to grace, as Jonathan Miles was saying in the Times. You don't feel any obligation to sort of bring this around to some lovely epiphany. It stays pretty rough in your work.
Well, I think there are, slight moments of grace here and there. But, I didn't end on any happy notes because, for a lot of these people, that's not the way it turns out. And, I sort of tried to be as, I guess, realistic in my fiction as I could be, at least with this book.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a town not called Hope. Knockemstiff, Ohio is the setting of a dark new collection of short stories called Knockemstiff. Its author is Donald Ray Pollock, 53, out with his first collection, and it'll knock your socks off if you can take it. Don, I wish you'd read from a story called Bakhtin. If you could jump right in, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. This is about the first page or so of Bakhtin. Mm-hmm. I've been staying out around Massyville with my crippled uncle because I was broke and unwanted everywhere else. and I spent most of my days changing his slop bucket and sticking fresh cigarettes in his smoke hole. Every 24 hours, I wiped him off with a wet cloth and turned his broken body over to air everything out. He'd been totaled in a freak car crash and had ended up with a giant settlement that cursed him with enough money to vegetate for the rest of his sorry-ass life. I was supposed to be staying straight. His daughter had even insisted I sign a damn scrap of paper. But late one night, I found myself messed up in a strange car littered with flakes of dead skin and stolen tools and those gas station cassettes that are always on sale for $1.99. The driver was a hillbilly guy named Jimmy who kept calling me cousin, but I couldn't even remember meeting him, let alone seeing him at one of the reunions we used to have when our family was still permitted in the state parks. Still, being the type of person I was, I'd apparently let him talk me into huffing several cans of Bactine, and then I was sick, and my brain felt like a frozen bleach bottle. As snow swirled all around us in the Walmart parking lot, I rinsed the inside of my face with Jimmy's last beer and vowed never to stick my head in a bread sack again. Sometime after that, around 3 a.m., we ended up at the Krispy Kreme looking for Phil, a friend of mine, who was supposed to have some second-all suppositories left over from his dead dad's unsuccessful bout with cancer. The Cream is the only thing open in our town after the bars close, where you might find people like us. But there was just Mrs. Leach, the cross-eyed waitress who always creeped me out because once, in jail, I'd held her son in my arms. Wherever I went in those days, I stumbled across the bill collectors and misfortunes of my past, while any chance of a future worth living kept spinning farther and farther away.
A future worth living kept spinning farther and farther away. Donald Ray Pollock reading from his collection, Knock 'em Stiff, there from the top of the story, Bactine, huffing Bactine. That's a new phrase to me. Lots of listeners want to speak with you, Don. Let's go to Mac in Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Mac. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Don, I had a question for you. I'm really interested in your work. I agree that your voice is very authentic. And when I come across a writer like you, I'm always interested in knowing who your influences were. Thematically, I'm hearing things maybe like Flannery O'Connor, maybe some Cormac McCarthy. Can you tell me, who do you read and who do you think's influenced your style?
Well, I agree that, I love Flannery O'Connor, and I've read quite a bit of Cormac McCarthy. Early on, I guess, for me, when I started typing stories out, for example, I did type stories out by Hemingway, John Cheever, Richard Yates, Brice Pancake. He's a big influence on me. William Gay, who's another Southern writer. I try to read pretty widely, but I guess probably if I was going to pick one certain group of writers out, it would probably be the Southern writers have had the biggest influence on me.
I've got to ask.
Maybe the fiction writers, too, crime fiction writers. Some of the old ones like Jim Thompson, David Goodis.
I've got to ask you about Sherwood Anderson. Of course, he wrote Winesburg, Ohio, back in 1919, kind of a short story cycle. But there, the front was sort of all-American white picket fence. The weird stuff was behind. You've got it right out front. Somebody called your collection Winosburg, Ohio.
Yeah.
What about Sherwood Anderson?
Well, I read Winesburg, Ohio, at least two or three times. And I've read it since I think my book came out. I've read most of the stories anyway since then. But I sort of look on that as, he was writing it in the early 20th century. So, and I think maybe just because of the times or whatever. I do think, it's probably an influence as far as just he set all the stories in the same place. And, there are reoccurring characters and stuff like that, just like in my book. So, I would have to say that book is an influence on mine.
How do you think of yourself culturally, geographically. Ohio's got many pieces to it. You're pretty far in the South. I know that kind of holler. There's a little one not so far across the Kentucky border, actually called Ashbrook, where I think some moonshine came out of it.
Right?
In its time. But do you see yourself as a Southerner, as a Southern writer, as a Southern Gothic writer?
I never have. If anything, I've just, sort of saw myself as an Ohio writer. I don't really care about, people sticking, like, regionalism tags or anything like that on me. I'd be proud to be known as an Ohio writer. But there is that Southern influence, I know, with my stuff. And, I really love those writers. So I can see where it's coming from.
Let's go to Vicki in East Hartland, Connecticut. Hi, Vicki. You're on the air with Donald Ray Pollack.
I just stumbled on to this program by chance, and I must tell you that I am mesmerized. I am fascinated. When I turned the radio on, Mr. Pollack was reading the story about being at the drive-in. I have lived in Connecticut for 30 years, but I grew up in the 60s and 70s in central West Virginia, and I mean, these are family and friends that Mr. Pollack is writing about, and I am just amazed. And I have found a new author. It's incredible.
Hey, thank you, Vicki.
Vicki,
well, you're very welcome.
We're glad to hear it. Come back on purpose. It's good to have you. Let's get a call from Garber, Iowa. Debbie, you're on the air with Donald Ray Pollack.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I grew up in Pennsylvania during the 60s and 70s. I was born in 52. And I used to feel like an alien with all of the TV shows like Andy Griffith or later on even the Waltons. I felt like an alien because my stories are very much like the stories that you're writing and reading from. And it's so nice to have a voice for this culture. You know, I come from family that was damaged, and our stories were unbelievable. So thank you.
Straight, you're welcome.
Straight thank you. Debbie, thank you very much for calling. Fascinating feedback here. Let's get another call from Saul in Boston. Saul, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. This is Saul. I'm calling from Boston. I just had a question because I was listening to very fantastic stories that you people are reading. And about the voting pattern of these people, is the same people that Hillary Clinton talking about the people that are voting for her?
It's a good question. Is this the white working class that's been so much talked about in the presidential campaign, Don?
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that in southern Ohio, at least down where I live, there are a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters. And, I'm a liberal. And what I'm afraid is going to happen, and, I can't really predict what's going to happen or anything, but it seems to me like a lot of these people who are for Hillary are, they're probably going to switch to John McCain.
Because of race issues, if it's Obama? Is it race or something else?
I hate to say it, but I think that it is. I wish people could get past, the color of a man's skin, but it seems like with people that I just run into and, we start talking about politics a little bit, it just does seem like, even though a lot of people won't really come out and admit it, I can't think of any other reason that it would be, other than that. And it's a shame. It really is. But, I don't know. I guess Hillary, she's got a lot of support down there. And maybe those are the people she's talking about.
Mm. Saul, thanks very much for your call. Don, I can't resist getting one more reading here. You've got a story where a couple of kids are out in the yard playing, I guess you'd call it. But what's been going on in their houses is really rough. One's mother being beaten by the father. Another's mother who wants him to, come in and play serial killer stalking her in the bedroom. Could you read a little bit from this story for us?
Sure. And let's see, just to set this up a little bit. William and Theodore are neighbors, and there's a big anthill that sits right on their property line. And they one of the games that they play is destroying this anthill, and then the ants build it back up again and that sort of thing. So they're getting ready to destroy the anthill again. "Did you bring the matches?" he asked. "Yesterday, William had finally agreed that if I brought the fire, we could kill Viet Cong this week. My mom and I watched bits of the war on TV every night, and I had waited all damn summer to wipe out a communist village." I pulled the box of blue kitchen matches out of my pocket, and he ran to retrieve the empty bleach bottle he'd stashed in a clump of horse weeds that grew along the sagging fence. "We got to be careful," he said, glancing back at his house. "The old man's on the war path again." "Jesus, don't that guy ever let up?" I said. The bruises on William's skinny arms were the color of a bum banana. All my life I'd wished for a father, but living next to Mr. Jenkins was making me have second thoughts. Mine had skipped out on my mom before I was born, and I'd always been ashamed of that. But maybe I'd lucked out after all. "Light it," he commanded, ignoring me. Ramming a long stick in the mouth of the bleach bottle, he held it over the fence. I struck a match and held the flame close to the bottom of the jug until it caught. Then, swinging the stick around, William positioned the melting bottle directly over the anthill. Sizzling drops of white plastic began raining down on the tiny red ants like a firestorm. "Look, Theodore," he said casually, "let's forget that Vietnam crap." "But you said we could..." "I can't stand it," he coughed. "It's all you ever talk about." Poisonous fumes were already swirling around his sweaty face. He waved his hand like a handkerchief, trying to fan the plastic smoke away. "Screw you," I said. "Find someone else to boss around." I was the only kid in Knockemstiff who would even talk to him, and that was just because my mom kept insisting that I play the good neighbor. Any time I pointed out to her that William treated me like crap, she'd look up from whatever she was doing and say, "Teddy, you have no idea what goes on over there. Like I said, just keep pretending that William's your friend, and before you know it, he will be."
Donald Ray Pollock reading from Gigantomachy, if I pronounce that right, one of the stories in his new collection, Knock 'em Stiff. I should say you can read an excerpt from Knock 'em Stiff at our website, onpointradio.org. Don, let's get a call from South Carolina, Winsboro, and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm a good-for-nothing nut Buckeye, too. Pearly gates or boiling pits. That is fantastic writing.
Thank you.
You know, it boils down to perspective. I think everything is damaged, too. But I wanted to make a point about the therapeutic value of writing, because I wrote a book, and it seemed to me about the same age. I didn't want to be a product of what I was born into. And my father was from South Carolina in the height of our year was coming from Ohio down to South Carolina to a tiny mill village where at one time Grandma and Grandpa and all 12 kids worked in a mill. And I wrote about that, and I faced everything that I was a product of. You know, I call it generational baggage, trying to shake it. But it was the single most therapeutic thing I've ever done in my life was to write about all that.
David, let us put it to Donald Ray Pollock. Don, how about it? You come across as you sound so level-headed. Are you exorcising demons here in Knock 'em Stiff?
No, I wouldn't put it that way. I mean, I can see what David's talking about, but... I don't know. For me, it was just a matter of, I'm repeating myself, I guess, but I wanted to change my life, and I thought that I wanted to be a writer, and this was my material, you know, and it was sort of like with the first book anyway, I decided, well, I better write what I can, you know, what I know about. I don't think I've felt any therapeutic. I guess I really didn't you know, have any problems with Nockham Stiff or, you know, anything like that. It was, I didn't blame the holler for, you know, how I had ended up or anything like that. I just blamed myself. So I don't think it was, you know, there was any need for therapy, maybe.
Well,
I guess what I'm trying to say.
Walt Whitman said he contained universes. If you've got no problem with any of this, you're a big guy, Don. You got room for a lot of troubled stuff in there. What are you hoping to draw out with from readers with this? Do you want them to, you know, come down and be social reformers, or just to think about the many faceted wonderment of life, no matter how dark? What?
Well, I hope that most readers can identify with some of these situations. Now, I know, yeah, mine are really gritty and rough, but at, you know, going back to what I was saying before, you know, I think most people, at one time or another in their lives, they become trapped, you know, maybe, you know, just for a year or so, maybe for 30 years. Mm. And I hope that, too, that they realize that, well, they can get out of that if they want to. If they want to do the work,
they can get out. Don, we're out of time.
Change their lives.
Yep. The new collection is Nockham Stiff. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.